G'day and welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Well, Donald Trump keeps making his mark on the world and he's not even president. He won't be until January 20. Now, did you hear about his phone conversation with Taiwan's president? Now, that's upset the Chinese, and for good reason. From Beijing's standpoint, giving legitimacy to Taiwan's president contradicts the One China policy. And that's been the bedrock of Sino-American relations since Nixon's opening in 1972. Meanwhile, we're having a great debate about what a President Trump means for our foreign policy. And no wonder. The Donald seems to represent everything about his country from which we shrink. But can Australia really withdraw from our strategic alliance with the US? Does America remain fundamental to our security? And should we expect some big disagreements between us and Uncle Sam in the Trump era? Today, we'll hear from two Australian scholars about the history as well as the future of the alliance. So let's get started. Well, you've probably been inundated with lots of commentary on Trump's election and what his presidency will mean for us. Well, for mine, the best thesis has just been published by the Lowy Institute. Now, as you know, certainly since 9/11, we've developed very close strategic and political relations with Washington. But according to James Curran, in coming years, we're likely to disagree more with the Americans. And history, he says, has prepared us well. After all, this isn't an alliance with its fair share of disagreements and divergence, especially in the 70s, 80s and 90s, perhaps a foretaste of the next 4 years. James Curran is Professor of History at the University of Sydney. His new book, published by Penguin this week, is called Fighting with America. Now, James, you were my first guest on Between the Lines in early 2015. Welcome back to the show.
Nice to be back, Tom. Thank you.
Now, James, from an historical perspective, does Donald Trump's victory really constitute a strategic shock for Australia?
Well, we certainly haven't seen a president-elect articulate the kind of lurid prescriptions for Asia and the US alliance system in the region like this before. Nothing quite as radical as this, a very transactional view of alliances with the Japanese and the Koreans, and his threat to, well, certainly he's already more or less ripped up the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But I think if you go back in history, we have faced much bigger seismic shocks to our international outlook. I'm thinking principally here of the decision by the British government in the early 60s to seek membership of the European Economic Community. Robert Menzies said then that that was the biggest decision in peacetime in his lifetime. And when the British added to that uncertainty by looking to withdraw their military from Southeast Asia, or from East of Suez, as they called it, and then we had the Nixon administration articulate a much less forward kind of posture in Asia, taken together, that period saw the collapse of Australia's Cold War policy. That is, the desire to keep the Americans and the British heavily engaged in Southeast Asia. And I think, you know, when you think about the headlines from that period, some of them were headlines like "Waken to Our Peril," you know, this fear of abandonment by the great powers. And that was particular reference to the British East of Suez.
Yeah, but if you look at Trump's record, I mean, so far he does talk the language about, you know, skepticism of American global leadership. Certainly he's been critical of the American penchant to subsidize allies' defenses. But on the other hand, his advisors sound like they're the kind of people who are very much committed to an activist engage American role in East Asia.
Well, they do. And I mean, you and your listeners will know about the article that came out from two of his advisors a couple of days before his election, which said,
in Foreign Policy magazine,
which said that he viewed the alliances in this region as the bedrock of stability. Now, one can only hope that that kind of cautious and moderate and more mainstream position on the US presence in the region will prevail. But if there's one thing we know about Trump, as has been demonstrated in recent days with his decision to receive a congratulatory call from the president of Taiwan, it's that he's unpredictable. He's not a protocol guy. There's more
erratic.
There's more than a touch of volatility. And this is why we need to take things with Trump one step at a time.
Now, the United States and Australia have been very loyal allies. You and I saw the former defense minister and Liberal leader Brendan Nelson once at a war memorial function where he was really pumped up about about the alliance and how there was nothing there to divide us and whatnot. And we were quite taken aback by this because, of course, we've studied the Suez Crisis in 56. But it is true we have marched in lockstep with the Americans in every major battle for the last century. But you say the history is more complicated. How so?
Well, I think this is one of the problems with the intense bipartisanship that has characterised the alliance in recent years. That is that the present circumstances are being treated as the norm. The fact that we have been so closely involved with the United States, particularly in the wake of 9/11, in the war on terror in the Middle East. And as you know, we are facing some of the most incredibly complex and fluid strategic circumstances in living memory. Mm. My point is to say that we risk waltzing into this complex future with a very flawed understanding of our strategic past, because we do seem to forget that in the past we have had serious differences of interest, particularly in this part of the world with the Americans. Now, you've mentioned Suez, but we've also had disagreements over Indonesia and a number of other areas.
Yes, well, I'm thinking about the opposition to Indonesia's annexation of West Papua in the early 1960s. That clashed with President Kennedy, didn't it?
Well, that's right. So the issue of West New Guinea was not solved by the achievement of Indonesian independence in 1949. Australia wanted the Dutch to retain West New Guinea as their last foothold in the East Indies, as it was then known. Sukarno wanted West New Guinea to complete the great Indonesian state. Australia believed it had a better ethnic claim to West New Guinea than any of the parties involved in the matter. Now, that sore continued to fester throughout the 1950s, but when the Kennedy administration came into power at the end of 1960 and early 61, they took the view that the sore couldn't be allowed to fester any longer. And Kennedy and the Americans said to the Australian government, "Do you realise that we have to make sure that we appease Sukarno's nationalist ambitions? Otherwise, we will tip him into the communist camp." And keep in mind, the Indonesians had the third biggest communist party outside of Moscow and Beijing at this time. And the classic statement was from one of Kennedy's advisors, Bob Comer, who said, "We need to teach the Australians that keeping Sukarno as a nationalist and satisfying his ambitions is much more important than 1,000 square miles of cannibal land." Mm. And Comer said, "Really, how long will the Australians' resentment last at this?" Yeah. So Australia was put in its place, and quite understandably, Australia came out of that crisis thinking, well, what is ANZUS supposed to mean? If we can't have meaningful consultation, if we can't get agreement from the Americans on issues that we feel touch our vital interests in the region, then what is the treaty for?
That's fascinating. And of course, Kennedy and his advisors were all Western values guys.
That's right.
What did Kennedy say about the alliance in the early 60s?
Kennedy, like all American presidents, could come out with a very soothing rhetoric about common values and fighting the Cold War struggle together. There's no doubt about that. But when it came to the confrontation episode with the Indonesians, he said the idea that America will back up Australia by putting Marines on the ground in the case of a conflict between Australia and Indonesia is farcical. We will give you logistical assistance, but we won't give you troops. He said, "The American people have forgotten about ANZUS."
Wow, that's amazing. And of course, there was the famous spats between Whitlam and Nixon, about which you've written in great detail in your book. Fast forward to the end of the Cold War. You quote Bill Hayden, the former Labor Foreign Minister, Governor General, in his memoirs in 1996, saying that the collapse of Soviet communism meant that, quote, "the strategic arrangement between Australia and the US has quietly laid down and to all practical intents and purposes expired." Hayden went on to say that much like CETO, that was the Southeast Asian Treaty Organization, the US alliance has, quote, "slipped into ineffectiveness."
It's a remarkable comment. And I think we need to remember that, you know, this period at the end of the Cold War was characterized by a lot of talk about the New World Order and the idea that the United Nations, for example, would be able to finally fulfill the vision that had been outlined for it by its founders. This was going to be the heyday of liberal internationalism. And I mean, it wasn't just Australians like Hayden casting a sceptical light on the need for alliances anymore. What's remarkable about that period, particularly when Keating was in office, is the amount of commentary which was suggesting that the American alliance was drifting. Now, of course, Keating at this time was giving engagement with Asia an intensity and an urgency that I think he made his own. And American commentators and some American officials, particularly those at the Pacific Command, were actually publicly saying the way forward for the United States in Asia is not necessarily through treaty arrangements. Now, you can imagine the apoplexy that that caused on Russell Hill in Canberra amongst defence planners. But Keating and Gareth Evans were constantly being asked to justify, how can you continue to have this policy of comprehensive engagement with Asia and maintain the alliance? And they were being criticised for letting the alliance wither on the vine.
So let me get this right then. You basically distinguish between two alliance traditions since Whitlam. You've got the sort of what you would call the normal alliance from 72, Whitlam's election, right through to 96, Keating's loss. And then you've got that more sort of pro-alliance, sentimental view post 9/11 under Howard, Rudd, Gillard, Abbott and Turnbull. That's the line, right?
That's right. Now, the key point here is that Whitlam, Fraser, Hawke and Keating all maintained that ANZUS was still the principal security guarantee for Australia. But none of them really did anything to give it a more substantial meaning or content because they were all basically pursuing this path of engaging with the Asia Pacific. That was their number one policy priority. Now, when John Howard was elected in 1996, he took a policy to that election of saying he wanted to revitalise and reinvigorate the American alliance. He believed that Hawke and Keating had allowed the alliance to suffer. He wanted to give the Americans more, and that included things like, he took this to the 96 election, pre-positioning American equipment in Australia, more training opportunities for the Marines. And I think from that time, there has been a kind of a very strong consensus among both parties that this alliance has to be strengthened and made the sort of number one security.
Yeah, all the way with USA. But to be fair, James, I mean, both Abbott and Turnbull have disagreed with the US over several things in the last 2 years or so. I mean, our inclusion in the China-led Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, that was under Abbott. We haven't followed through with those freedom of navigation patrols in the South China Sea. We haven't said we're going to host the B-1 bombers, or even there's still conflict there between Washington and Canberra over how we should pay for the US Marines rotation, even the lease of the Darwin port.
Yeah.
I could go on. So isn't that evidence that Australia is indeed under Gillard and Rudd, and certainly under Abbott and Turnbull, showing independence within the alliance?
Well, to some extent, yes. I mean, I don't think there's any doubt that the Americans would have preferred us not to join the AIIB, even though now they concede it was a diplomatic shambles, the way they handled their alliances with it. And I think they would like to see the freedom of navigation patrols. But the real, I think, point for the United States is they would be looking at those kinds of incidents and looking for when they reach a kind of an accumulation where they would be concerned that Australia is tipping into the Chinese orbit. So these are disagreements, and this proves my point about there being a kind of a tradition within Australian defence and foreign policy that from time to time we take a different path. But I think broadly speaking in that post-96 period, apart from freedom of navigation, I don't think there's been a really serious disagreement between Canberra and Washington. Certainly none of the kind that we saw between Whitlam and Nixon, or indeed during the Hawke years. I don't think there's been anything of that kind of magnitude.
My guest is James Curran, author of a new Lowy paper called Fighting with America, and yet we should expect more differences with a Trump in the White House.
Well, I think so. I think he will find that if he wants to achieve anything, he will need alliances. We know that he has a transactional view of alliances. We know that they are going to attract a certain scrutiny in American politics in a way that they haven't before. There will be more focus on what the US is getting out of these arrangements. But it won't only be the Americans asking us more. I think Australia will be concerned if isolationist and protectionist trends gain further traction. And we are not used to an America on the back foot. We're not used to an America that is not talking the language of Pax Americana and global engagement. And I think we'll want the Americans to do more.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I'm going to put you on the spot here because you do argue that we should reject US policies that hurt our economic relations with China. That makes sense. But you also seem to agree with Kim Beazley that we would have, quote, no alternative but to line up militarily beside the US. Otherwise, the alliance would be effectively dead and buried. James, is there a contradiction there?
I don't think so. I mean, look, I don't think we're facing any time soon, apart from some kind of serious miscalculation, for example, in the South or East China Seas. I don't think we're facing a hot war between the United States and China anytime soon. This is where I disagree with some of the other commentary that's about and has been for some time. I think this US-China relationship will be characterized by cooperation, sometimes disagreement, sometimes intense disagreement. But the language of interdependence and the reality of Chinese and American independence is quite strong. I don't see China as a revisionist power. It's done very well out of the international environment, and I can't see that it would want to upset as well its deep economic integration with the East Asian economies. Now, any kind of confrontation, as I said, will depend upon the circumstances. I do think that because of how deeply rooted the alliance is in Australia's DNA and its values, that by and large, Beazley is probably right. But there is enough kind of ambiguity and ambivalence in the comments that we've seen in the last decade from people like Alexander Downer, the former foreign minister, and the former defence minister, David Johnston, that this will arguably create a diabolical policy dilemma for Australia. Yes, for the moment, we can continue to ride those two horses simultaneously. We've been doing it quite deftly and delicately. But I suspect, especially what we've seen in the last few days with Trump on Taiwan, this is just going to become harder.
And I was going to say, since Nixon's opening to China, and indeed Whitlam's opening to China in the early 1970s, it's fair to say that both our nation's national interests has been best served by the one China policy.
That's right.
Having that balance there in the Taiwan Straits, maintaining the status quo, giving de facto support to the Taiwanese, but that strategic ambiguity that you mentioned. And anything that upsets that balance is not in our interest, and it makes us a prisoner of events. Just say, for argument's sake, Trump does ramp up the relationship with Taiwan, the Chinese react with some strategic missiles, just like they lobbed in the Taiwanese Straits in early 1996.
Mm-hmm.
And the Americans then send a couple of aircraft carriers to the Taiwan Straits, and we're encouraged to support the Americans, and a Prime Minister Turnbull or an Abbott or a Shorten say no.
It's quite conceivable, and I do think that if that kind of situation eventuates, where it is clearly a provocative decision by this new Republican president, that an Australian Prime Minister would have every reason to not support the United States. Now, we know that there has been significant pressure from various American officials. You need only remember what Richard Armitage said, that he would expect there to be Australian blood on the beaches.
This is Richard Armitage, the Deputy Secretary of State in the Bush administration.
That's right, that Australia would have to do some of the dirty and hard and dangerous work if it came to that.
Mm-hmm.
And we've heard John Mearsheimer on your program say that Australia would feel the white heat of American anger. But nevertheless, I don't think it would cause the treaty to be ripped up. I think Australian governments would have every right. If this was an American provocation, they would have every right to stand aside and say this is not in our interests.
James, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Tom.
That was James Curran, author of a new Lowy Institute book published this week. It's called Fighting with America.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, we've just been talking about the very real divergence of interests that has dogged our alliance relationship with the Americans. Now let's talk about the future of this alliance. Now, this year marked the 65th anniversary of the security treaty between Canberra and Washington. It's also, believe it or not, the 50th anniversary of the first presidential visit to Australia. That was LBJ on the eve of the 66 election. That was between Labor's Arthur Calwell and Harold Holt. But some say that in the wake of Trump's election, it's time to cut the tag. Here's former Prime Minister Paul Keating recently.
And in foreign policy terms, we're getting the message from President-elect Donald Trump that he's a big power guy and he's not for alliances. Like, wink, wink, you may be on your own. I mean, what we have to do is make our way in Asia ourselves with an independent foreign policy. I mean, isn't an independent, balanced foreign policy the right answer? Or do we stay in a crouch saying Hail Marys to the alliance? The foreign policy of Australia is basically we have tag-along rights to the US and we conduct our foreign policy, certainly since I left public office in the Howard years with Iraq, you know, and in years since, we've had a more or less a tag-along foreign policy, tag-along the United States. It's time to cut the tag, time to get out of it.
Now, for more on the future of the alliance, let's chat with Peter Dean. He's a fellow and director of studies at the Strategic Defence Studies Centre at the Australian National University. He's also an editor of Australia's American Alliance. That's just out from Melbourne University Publishing. Peter, welcome to the show.
Great to be here.
Owen Harries, my old friend, the inaugural editor of the National Interest in Washington and Australian, he once quipped that Americans needed good peripheral vision to be able to find Australia on a map. Have Washington's attitudes changed in recent times?
Yes, I think they have. And I think this comes back to, in all good strategy, a map's important and geography matters. And Coral Bell, who is a wonderful writer on international affairs and worked at my centre and wrote a great book on the alliance, Coral has this great line that US interest in Australia is always directly related to the US interest in Asia. And the more that the United States are interested in Asia, the more they're interested in Australia. And this goes back to, you know, the Pacific War and World War II, Korea and Vietnam, for instance, as well as trade. And we've seen this with what looks like to be defunct TPP. In regional order, things like bringing America into APEC and the East Asian Summit. And of course, we had the pivot and then later the rebalance under the Obama administration, which was heavily orientated on the Asia-Pacific region and obviously involved Australia very heavily as well.
Okay, so your argument then is that deeper US engagement with Australia is necessary to help boost America's presence in Asia, which has helped guarantee the peace and stability. But what's in it for us other than that equilibrium? What do we get out of this alliance?
Oh, we get an enormous amount out of the alliance. I mean, everything from our Five Eyes intelligence relationship, which, you know, provides a capability that we simply just could not provide to ourselves, from conventional deterrence and extended nuclear deterrence. And most importantly in the region, what the United States has done for most of those 65 years is provide a balance of power in the region. It's been a hegemon in the region, and it's been a good hegemon for Australia. It's provided regional order and stability. And since the end of the Vietnam War, it's been a very, very stable region. And that stability provided by US security and its presence in the region is what's been able to make Australia prosper and Japan and the countries of Southeast Asia and, of course, China itself.
My guest is Peter Dean, who, along with Brendan Taylor and Stephen Fruling, is editor of Australia's American Alliance. That's just out by MUP. Peter, how would you respond to the Paul Keating, Malcolm Fraser argument that under Labor and coalition governments of recent times, our independence in foreign policy deliberations has been lacking?
I don't really agree with the former prime ministers on this one. I mean, they take a different stance on this. Fraser was, of course, very much linking his argument to the neoconservative movement in America that no longer exists and was only in power for a very short period of time. And I think what we're really seeing here is that Australia's continued to have its own independent foreign policy, very closely connected with the alliance. Where I think that statement is probably maybe a little bit
more accurate. Well, how so? How can you give examples of how we've been independent?
Well, we've always had a very strong United Nations focus, a very strong focus on liberal internationalism, on multilateralism, which the United States has not always gone along with. You know, you go back into the 80s and 90s in Asia, where we had a lot of very fierce discussions and conversations with the United States around trade and around trade development and also the role of different regional order building mechanisms. Mm. And we've been very closely connected to the United States, but I don't think it's a one-track foreign policy. Now, where I think there might be a little bit more in it is if you look at strategic or defence policy. And I would sort of argue that I've been quite concerned in the last decade or two how our defence policy has started to look more and more one track built around the US alliance.
Yeah, because I was going to say, isn't one of Fraser's points before he died that since 2012 or thereabouts, the deputy commanding general of the US Army in the Pacific has been an Australian. So we're so intermeshed with the US military that this was Fraser's argument, and I suspect Keating goes along with this, that if a conflict erupted in the Asia Pacific, we'd be automatically committed to a US war, wouldn't we?
Well, here I think you need to diversify the difference between the treaty document that we signed with ANZUS and what I like to call the alliance. So if you go back and actually look at the treaty, it's actually quite vague. You know, we commit to basically negotiate and discuss and talk about issues of security concerns in Asia. It's not like NATO, an automatic trigger for us to go to war. And there is the diplomatic room there for both the United States to not side with us and us to not side with the United States. And the other factor I think it's very difficult and you need to consider, of course, is we're part of an alliance system in Asia. We'd seen President Obama commit the United States to defend the Senkaku Islands in the treaty with Japan. Now, the question is, if that was invoked and some conflict started over those islands, where would that leave Australia?
Yeah.
We would certainly have to consult over that issue is what the treaty says, but how far the alliance relationship, everything built on top of that treaty, drags us into that automatically is a difficult question to answer. And of course, if a Australian Prime Minister did say no to something, the question is, what would that impact upon the alliance more generally? And how would we unstitch a lot of the very close woven fabric that is that alliance or relationship over the last 65 years?
But Peter, alliances don't last forever. Let's get your reaction to something Harvard University's Stephen Walt, he's a past guest on this show, this is what he's observed. Quote, "The alliance may be dead long before anyone notices, and the discovery of the corpse may come at a very inconvenient moment." Peter.
Oh, it's a brilliant line, and in fact, I use it quite often. And one of my fellow editors of this book, Brendan Taylor, who I cooperate a lot on my work on the Alliance, we have a bit of a running thing that when we write something either together or separately, we always try and get this Stephen Walt quote in because it's just so brilliant. And I think it's a really important thing to remember about alliances. What Walt is really saying here, you cannot be complacent. You cannot allow assumptions you've had in the past to drive where you're thinking about it currently and where you go into the future. You need to ask hard questions of yourself and of your alliance partner over your mutual interests and your mutual ideas. You shouldn't make assumptions. You shouldn't be complacent. You shouldn't allow the alliance relationship just to drift on same old, same old. You need to ask questions. You need to probe. You need to negotiate. You need to have these hard discussions.
Penny Wong had a piece, the Labor foreign affairs spokesperson, had a piece in the Fairfax Press a few weeks ago where she was saying the alliance could actually change in the Trump era. I mean, could that happen? I mean, does Australia risk being seen as a free rider? I think this is the word that Trump uses, a free rider in the alliance, unless we increase our defence spending.
The alliance has changed and evolved over its 65-year history innumerable amount of times. As the strategic environment changes, as the US and Australia's standing economically and internationally changes, so the alliance has had to change and evolve, particularly at what I would argue at key pivot points in its history, the Vietnam War, the Nixon Doctrine, the end of the Cold War, and it's constantly in a process of change. Now, even if Hillary Clinton had been elected, the alliance as we know it is still changing because the region we live in and the globe we live in is changing, and it will have to adapt irrespective. Now, I think Trump will accelerate that change, but it was going to happen anyway. Now, in terms of free riding, well, Trump has talked about almost a cost-benefit analysis of each of his alliances. And I think I'm very confident that if the Trump people did a cost-benefit analysis of the ANZUS alliance, the US-Australian relationship, that we would come out very well out of that. And it seems from some small indications we've had about the engagement so far with Malcolm Turnbull and Trump's people, and of course Joe Hockey and Julie Bishop during the campaign, that they seemed rather, at least on the surface, positively predisposed to our relationship.
Peter, thanks so much for being on RN today.
My pleasure.
That was Peter Dean from the Strategic Defence Studies Centre at ANU. Now to our recommended list. And this week's shock that John Key has resigned as Prime Minister of New Zealand. Now, you may have heard me quote Enoch Powell. He's the prominent British Conservative MP. This is what he once said. All political careers end in failure. And I think generally speaking, Powell was right. You think about it, some political careers end in a bang, others in a whimper, and even the mighty fall, and they fall mighty hard, don't they? You think of Thatcher in 1990, Hawke in 91, Howard in 2007. Now, Powell had some good advice. If only political leaders had cut off their political careers in midstream at a happy juncture. Well, I think it's fair to say that John Key has followed Enoch Powell's advice and he's defied the Powell doctrine that all political careers end in failure. So this week, we dedicate a few articles to Key, New Zealand's Prime Minister for the past 8 years. And for that and more on Australia and the world, go to our homepage, abc.net.au/rn, and follow the prompt. And remember, if you'd like to hear our program again or even send us a comment, just go to that site. Thanks for your company on Between the Lines this week. I'm Tom Switzer. Always great to chat. Hope you can tune in next week.